Good morning and welcome to the September 7th, 2021 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Board of Commissioners. Today we are meeting in regular and in study and business session. It appears that our agenda may be somewhat abbreviated today and we might accidentally finish all of our business in one session, but that still remains to be seen. So I just thought I would let people know that for purposes of planning. And I haven't got a cheat sheet in front of me for the instructions I like to share with people, so I'll sort of ad-lib it and remind everybody that, well, first of all five commissioners are present. Lorna Klemanski is acting director, acting general manager today. Katie Yount is acting counsel. And Rebecca Newman is our clerk of the board in attendance. And I know there's a variety of others in attendance online, and we appreciate having you. Just a reminder that you could silence your cell phone if you're going to be talking. Otherwise, we would ask that you remain on mute unless you are talking. Because of the COVID, we are still meeting virtually, and it's... hopefully someday we'll see everybody face to face again in the not too distant future. We're all looking forward to that day, but today we're still meeting virtually. And for those in the public that are at this meeting, we will provide a time at the end of our study session to have public input and we always appreciate that public input, and if anybody is on the line, we ask that you keep your comments to 3 minutes in that section that we allow for public input. So without further ado, I would like to ask Larry Peterson to provide for us the Pledge of Allegiance and the Safety Minute.
All right. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. When I think about HPI, I think about the phrase, that's the way we've always done it. It's a phrase that closes the door on thought and consideration of what you're doing. HPI stresses the fact that we are all human and going to make mistakes, many of which are predictable and unfortunately expose the district to unwanted risk. Risk through injury to employees, damage to property, or environmental concerns. My name is Larry Peterson, and I'm the lead operator at the PUD Wastewater Treatment Plant at Lake Wenatchee. I bid the position March of 2020. The system includes a 1.3-acre lagoon, half-acre sand filter, 14-acre spray field, lab, and approximately 240 septic tanks, which are owned and operated by the district. The septic tanks operate very much like a traditional septic tank. The only difference is the water leaving the tank gets pumped back to the plant for further treatment rather than flowing to a traditional drain field. This leaves solids in the tank, which must be then manually pumped out by a septic truck every 5 to 10 years. I think there's some pictures that go along with this. If we could get up to 2 and 3, there's a picture of the lagoon. Less than a year after taking the superintendent position, Sean Desi began to reconsider location of new tank installs. Previously, it seems tanks were placed at customer convenience and ease of gravity flow. This has left us with tanks incredibly close to the water and risk overflow with immediate environmental concerns. Tanks are now placed with consideration for maintenance and lower risk of immediate overflow in the event of pump or float failure. These locations are also more cost-effective to maintain and easier on employees to access. We get to pictures 4 and 5. The risk and exposure of the old tanks still looms. We have tanks that are very difficult to reach and nearly impossible to pump and maintain. These pictures show a stairway of over 40 steps to access a tank and control panel. I've developed new techniques for pumping these tanks, which is less costly and will hopefully result in less overtime and unscheduled callouts. Picture 7, please. One more. There we go. This is the HPI philosophy and principles. Number one, we all make errors. So a lot of these, possibly not the best location for the tanks, looking back. Number two, errors follow a reoccurring pattern. We know the tanks are going to fail. Pumps, floats, or simply overuse. Number three, curiosity drives us to examine our practices. We looked at where they were being placed and wondered why. Number four, we as employees are the solution. We no longer place tanks next to the lake in four locations and are working hard to maintain the tanks that are. Picture eight. Excellence is not the absence of failure, but the presence of process and defenses. How do we achieve excellence? Well, it's my goal to not have failures of these tanks, and with your help, possibly move existing tanks to better locations. I hope to see a day when these difficult tanks are relocated using principles we now use in cutting the district's exposure to risks associated with their location. We know failures can and do happen, and placing tanks away from the lake is the key. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. That was more than just a safety minute. That was also an education, one that I really appreciate. How many of those tanks are close to the lake? You had said there's 240 tanks.
Yeah, I would say that there are, well, they're all close to the lake. I mean, it's North Shore and Cedar Brae, but I would say that there's roughly 15 to 20 that are really close to the lake. That if they were to be installed today, we would not be placing them where they currently are. We would be putting them closer up to the road, easier to access, and by all means, further away from the lake.
So I have a question, Larry. If that property sold, would the new owner then have to relocate the tanks, move them further?
No, the tanks are they're all ours. It's
all
a PUD
ours?
Maintained. Yep.
210 of them.
240.
Oh wow! Oh, missed that. Okay.
And so and the property sells and comes and goes, and meanwhile the 240 tanks are ours to maintain, infinitely.
How did I miss that? Well, I miss a lot, I guess. Wow.
So it keeps me pretty busy up here, trying to keep ahead of this and get through holiday weekends like we had, and hopefully not have any call-outs. That means everything went well.
So at what point would we move those tanks individually, a tank at a time? What would precipitate that?
Well, without something from a level of where you guys are at, it's not something that we can just, in my opinion, it's not something that's just going to happen. I mean, it's going to take something bigger, more help, more funding, more money to get these tanks relocated. And it would be the PUD's responsibility to relocate these and then come up with some kind of a solution for the homes to then, you know, pump their waste up to our tank and then have them assume responsibility of another pump that's down lower.
How is the health department? I'm just curious. How is the health department involved? Do they do any regular monitoring or anything?
No, the health department isn't involved. I report directly to the Department of Ecology through water samples of the water coming in and going out of the plant. So I report to Ecology. I do a DMR every month that tells them the results of the water coming in. The characteristics of the water going out to the spray field in the summer or to the river in the winter.
Hmm. Wow. Interesting. Thank you.
All right.
Gary.
So, Larry, I have a question. You showed a tank, I think it was picture number 7, down by the water. and I think you referred to that one as being at the bottom of the 40 steps. Whose responsibility is it to pump it out, the solids, that is, and how in the world do they do it?
Well, that's our responsibility. That falls right to me. It's complicated because a septic truck only has maybe 17 to 18 feet of lift. And, right. And you can see that tank is well over that. So what I bought this winter was a pump that will pump anything. The demo on this pump, they threw Levi's and leather gloves into it, and it pumped them. It's incredible. So I now have a pump that I believe I can put in these tanks, and it will make everything in that tank go uphill, and where it'll meet the septic truck, and we'll get it taken care of. But I also have another tool I purchased this winter, which is a mixing tool, which can mix the solids into a slurry, which can then be pumped. So the thought is mix it up and then pump it up the hill.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good job.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great. Like I said, more than a safety moment and a great education for us here today. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Randy, I've got one more question for Larry.
Okay.
So Larry, so this is a question, but we wouldn't actually move the existing tanks. We would just put the new tanks in where we need to and then reconfigure the plumbing and leave those old tanks buried?
I'm not sure how that would work. I don't know if it would be more, it would likely be more effective to have a smaller tank down by the house that would have a homeowner-owned grinder pump in it that would boost everything up the hill to us rather than leaving the old tanks. The old tanks are concrete or fiberglass. And in my opinion, it would likely be more effective with a smaller chamber and a pump that the homeowner would then maintain. That's the tricky part is right now they gravity flow a lot of these to our tank, and they would then be assuming responsibility of a smaller tank perhaps and their own grinder pump to get the water and solids to us.
I would just in my mind thinking if all that was placed and decommissioned the old tanks, we would just fill them up and leave them there and cover them up and not have to disturb, haul big tanks and get trains to pick them up. And
that would be the way.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. So we're now at item 2 on our agenda, which is the approval of the agenda. And we received a recommendation a little earlier last week to move agenda item 6 to the consent agenda, and it's been renumbered. It is now agenda item 7. So unless there's any objection, we will move agenda item 7 to the consent agenda. Any objection? And hearing none, at this time also, if there's any member of the public that wishes to speak to any item on the agenda, we would have to have approval of the commission. Is there anybody that wishes to speak, any member of the public that wishes to speak to any item on the agenda? Hearing none then, we will go to agenda item 3, and I will turn the conduct of the meeting over to Lorna Klemanski.
Thank you, Commissioner, and Aline will be making a presentation today. This has two items in it. The board has completed, the Scientific Advisory Board has completed their review of David Welch's paper that we discussed at a previous board meeting, comparing salmon survival in dammed and undammed rivers. And the board has some thoughts about that. And there will also be an update on the wildlife mitigation program with a very low cost.
Thanks, Lorna. My name is Aline Underwood. I'm the manager of Fish and Wildlife Programs at the district. With me today is Vaughn Pope, our senior wildlife biologist. And Lorna just gave us a great introduction to our presentation. And we'll go ahead and advance the slides here. So we're just going to give a brief update on a discussion that we had back in June on a Welch paper. And then Vaughn's going to talk to us about the Rocky Reach Wildlife Program, which, frankly, we haven't talked to the board about in a considerable amount of time. So this is a really great opportunity for us to be able to do that. So really quickly, I presented in the June 21st meeting that there are some interesting things going on with papers being produced about ocean survival and things of that nature that might benefit the board for some, you know, greater context about the SAM recovery work that we do here in the Columbia. One of those papers that we talked about was the Welch et al. Paper, and the general topic of the Welch paper was that all stocks of Chinook salmon were declining along the West Coast at about the same rate, and concluded that the most likely cause is poor ocean conditions. So basically that there was no difference between the dammed and undammed rivers. So why this was important potentially for us, obviously, is that we spend a lot of time and money, as well as our other, you know, federal and PUD counterparts, and get a lot of pressure on salmon recovery. We want to make sure that we are looking at all effects to salmon recovery. So one of the things I indicated in the June meeting was that this paper was going to be reviewed by the Independent Science Advisory Board, which is directed by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. And they did review the paper. And there was two things that I think are worth mentioning here. They generally agreed with Welch's assertion that survival is similar for dammed and undammed rivers. So what that does is that lets us know that, and specifically they talked about the Fraser River and some issues going on there. So what that can do is that merely indicates, that's another data point for us to use, that we are doing all that we can for salmon recovery in our basin. But there are other things at play to which we do not have control that are really important in the full life cycle analysis of Chinook. But we thought it was worth also mentioning that there was probably more in the ISAB review that they disagreed with than they agreed with. And two items of particular interest, that they disagreed with Welch's assertion regarding habitat investment effectiveness and delayed mortality. So briefly, the habitat investment effectiveness had to do with Welch made an assertion that because the survival was similar for dammed and undammed rivers, that all the money that everyone's spending for habitat in the tributaries is not worthwhile. And the ISAB concluded that was a gross generalization, that data set could not lend itself to that conclusion, and encouraged, you know, Welch and others to look at different data sets about that. And then also they disagreed with the assertion about that delayed mortality wasn't an issue. Delayed mortality is basically the hypothesis that as fish travel downstream, as adults come upstream, returning from the ocean, that as they encounter the dams, there is a potential for some delayed mortality that occurs that cannot be measured, but it's just the effect of them passing through the dam. And this actually occurs for juveniles too. So the ISAB did not agree with that. Steve thought that it was really important that we mention that there was more to their paper than just the survival for dammed and undammed rivers for the full context. So I will, at this point, unless there are specific questions about that, I'm happy to turn it over to Vaughn. I can either answer questions now or later about that if there are.
Dan.
Thanks, Randy. Aline, yeah, so the last assertion what they disagreed with was that there's no delayed mortality effect caused by the dams. That's what they disagreed with in Welch's paper?
Yeah, to be more clear, Welch asserted that because there was no difference between dammed survival and dammed and undammed rivers, that using a similar data set led to the fact that there's no or that delayed mortality is essentially not really a thing that we should be considerate about. And the ICB disagreed with that. They said that the data, that was too much of a stretch for the data set that was used, that delayed mortality potentially is occurring in the river, and that more work was needed to be done to identify that.
Which so there are just so many factors. I mean, it seems like, it seems like the data should be clear, but I guess what they're saying is that there's so many other factors that require examining. It's not that cut and dried.
Yes, you know, and frankly, folks have been arguing about delayed mortality for the better part of 30 years. So it's not surprising that the ISAB would disagree with the assertion that delayed mortality does not exist.
Just real quickly, what's Welch's background again? What's his?
He is a fisheries biologist who works for a company called Katana Research in British Columbia. He's like a well-known statistician and biologist.
Thank you.
Okay, Dennis?
Yeah, Eileen, can you give me a working definition of delayed mortality? I mean, I can assume something here, but that assumption may not be what you're referring to.
Good question. So delayed mortality is the assertion that when a fish passes through the dam, whether it be a juvenile on its outmigration or an adult returning, that there is some effect caused by them passing the dam, likely through a turbine or even a spillway, that causes that fish to die a certain period after it passes the dam.
Okay, thank you.
It's kind of counterintuitive because you hear delayed mortality, so you think of the word delayed, right, and think, oh, that's a good thing. It's delayed longer, but no, it's just the opposite. It's not a good thing.
They just die later.
They just die later. Right. They do die, yeah. The delayed kind of throws you off, doesn't it? At least it did me, Dennis, at first. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and the one thing I'll add is, you know, candidly, fish come back to die. So the adults do. So this is where it is very difficult. The data set that exists to describe and to quantify the potential for delayed mortality is very, very nuanced. You know, data can say basically whatever you want it to say. So there's some people that in the science community believe that delayed mortality is a thing. And there's some people that use a different data set that say it isn't.
So, Eileen, does the effect of predators play into delayed mortality?
It certainly can. I think a lot of things related to what happens to fish as they travel upstream and downstream. We've often, you know, said that it could be predators. It could be predators that occur to juveniles as they're heading downstream. It could be adult predation as they return from the ocean. There are a lot of things that can affect whether or not a fish survives to its final destination in the tributary.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I have a question, Randy.
Okay.
Am I seeing this correctly, that any fish that dies after it passes any dam could be bundled into a category called delayed mortality, and a certain group might attribute that death then to a dam just because it passed the dam? Is that sort of being proposed here?
That's exactly right. That's a very excellent way of succinctly describing how some people construe delayed mortality, which I will say is important for us because this is why we have our really robust survival standards that, you know, we ensure that a fish makes it through not just our dam, but through our entire reservoir. And our stakeholders have agreed that that is adequate to show excellent survival through the hydro system, through our hydro project.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Ann.
Okay, one more quick question. So who knows where this will end up, where this will go, but so it could ultimately affect our habitat conservation plan targets and so forth. And you know, we have the tributaries and we have the fish raising and all the other things that we do. So those could be ultimately affected by this, right?
Well, I would actually say that our HCP, the way it's written, protects us against the use of data to suggest that there's some boogeyman in the river, potentially dealing mortality. Because the HCP is so specific in how it describes how our impacts are to be mitigated and how our impacts are to be measured. So, and there's actually nothing in our HCP that describes or talks about delayed mortality. So from my perspective, the HCP gives us that assurance that people can keep poking at hydro like they always have done and they will continue to do. But because our HCP is written as solidly as it is, that gives us an extra shield up when we get confronted by folks that say this is a real issue without potentially a lot of data. So I think the HCP can help us in this regard.
And would FERC be the only one through the relicensing, through a relicensing, would that be the only place where this could be, this HCP could be modified, changed, they could make demands on us to do more? Wouldn't that be through the licensing, relicensing process? Seems like that's the only place they could touch it.
So potentially, although the HCP is also written, I mean, it really is a brilliant document in that the only way for a stakeholder or a signatory of the HCP to get out of the HCP at any time, because everyone wanted that long-term certainty, is actually to prove that there is some effect, a new effect by the dam itself that is prohibiting recovery of a listed species, or in our case, any planned species, which includes listed and unlisted. So while FERC, once we go through Rock Island relicensing, will have to acknowledge that the HCP exists, it still exists for the 50-year term of the HCP through 2054. So part of that coverage and those shields up solid program will be, you know, through the duration of the part of the new license.
Thank you.
So may I ask one more? Yeah.
Okay.
So I mean, I'm thinking that if I'm migrating Chinook salmon and I get to the ocean and those conditions have changed and I don't become as robust and as healthy a salmon as my predecessors, my ancestors, and I then turn and go back up the river, would that not, a weakened salmon have a higher chance of delayed mortality than previous?
If the ocean conditions weren't suitable, which, you know, the ocean conditions sort of oscillate between being really pretty decent and really quite terrible, which is what we've seen over the last 10 years, I would say that, yes, that was part of, you know, Welch's assertion, which is it's not just about what's going on the river. It's about what's going on outside of the river.
Yeah.
I.e. the ocean that can really have an effect on the quality of the fish and their ability to endure their migration upstream.
Yeah. Well, the reason for, you know, asking the question is this weekend I read an assertion that basically from approximately Los Angeles to somewhere up the British Columbia coastline, the ocean conditions have changed, but the blame for that change wasn't climate. It was the effect of the four dams on the Snake River, which I thought was a pretty wild assumption. So that's kind of the reason behind some of my questions.
Yep, lots of really good questions. I think this is what, one of the reasons we wanted to come and talk about, you know, this particular paper is all of these data sets are used in various forums to promulgate a particular agenda. So we just want to give as much information to you all as we can.
Yeah, and this was a person pro removing the snake dams. So, yeah, I thought it was pretty far-reaching.
Okay. Any other questions for Aline? Thank you, Aline. Interesting and insightful.
You're welcome.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Vaughn Pope, the senior wildlife biologist for the district. And as Aline mentioned, we haven't talked about the Rocky Reach wildlife, particularly in a habitat wildlife management issue for quite a few years. Just a quick background, the license was awarded in 2009, and in that license it incorporated most of the wildlife articles from the 2006 Rocky Reach Settlement Agreement. When FERC issued the license that included the articles, they required that the district submit five-year plans that for their approval every 5 years, that we have to get their approval to go forward with these plans. And there are two kind of main components of the Rocky Reach Wildlife Habitat Management Program, and one is for the plan governs the funding that we set aside in the settlement agreement for wildlife habitat improvements that are conducted by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service. And per the settlement agreement, the Rocky Reach Wildlife Area is defined as this large bubble around the reservoir. It's a 3-mile buffer around the entire reservoir. So the wildlife project for Rocky Reach is quite a lot larger than the actual project area itself, and that was defined through negotiation in the settlement agreement. So it's a pretty large area, and again, one of the primary focuses is to manage funding that we've given to the agencies through the license to do habitat improvements. The other component of the habitat plan that we get approved every 5 years is annual wildlife monitoring within that Rocky Reach Wildlife Area, and that's what I'm going to focus on with my couple of slides today. That amount of funding was capped at $2,500 annually. That's $200 in the 2006 dollars. Currently, that's about $13,000 this year that we'd be spending on doing wildlife monitoring. And that monitoring is guided by the Rocky Reach Wildlife Forum. The Wildlife Forum is comprised of all the agencies, NGOs, tribes that are signatories to the settlement agreement. So they propose and approve the funding as long as it's consistent with the settlement agreement, what's in the license. And the intent is to monitor for rare, threatened, and endangered species. And that was to provide some flexibility through time for the term of the license to be able to address new things as they come up versus having to change plans and things all the time. So we have an annual plan that they approve and monitor, but the approved plan also states that Chelan PUD will not be responsible for any protection, mitigation, or enhancement measures that might be proposed from any monitoring we would conduct. So we can help the agencies maybe do some monitoring for their rare, threatened, and endangered wildlife species, but we're not going to be responsible for any protection, mitigation, or enhancement measures that might come from that. So just a kind of a quick history of where we've been. Again, the license was approved in 2009. The current plan that we're in was just approved on June 9th, 2021 by FERC. So we're in our third plan now. And from 2010 to 2014, the first Rocky Reach Wildlife Plan that was approved, we were doing some things from the previous license because that said what we needed to do was just continue what we had done in previous license. And a lot of that was Canada goose nest monitoring, which frankly we don't need to do anymore. Winter and nesting bald eagle surveys, that was kind of left over from when bald eagles were listed as endangered. They're no longer on the endangered species list, so we don't they've recovered quite well. We don't need to be spending time and money on those. So in the second plan, we moved on to some, we continued doing some bald eagle monitoring. We also did some golden eagle nest monitoring, and then we started to move into more of the rare or unusual species surveys, spotted owls, Chelan mountain snail, and most recently we started to do some spotted bat surveys along our reservoir at the recommendation of the Yakima tribes. We continued that monitoring in 2021, and I will tell you that we've observed a lot of bald and golden eagle nesting in our area. The bald eagles are going up, the golden eagles are going down. Spotted owls, we did not find any in the area that we looked, which benefited the Forest Service and the way they manage that habitat now. The mountain snails are, again, something that we look for. They document it, and then they kind of manage where that is. We have documented spotted bats along the reservoir, which is kind of an unusual species in this area. And this year we've done some pilot studies for Lewis's and white-headed woodpeckers at the request of DFW. So it's worked out fairly well, and I guess from 2022 to 2025, we'll see what the agencies propose and what we end up doing with that funding. Does anybody have any questions?
I guess I have one question, just a curiosity question. You made a comment that the bald eagle is going up and the golden eagle is going down. Is that a direct relationship that the bald eagle is more dominant and therefore pushing the golden eagle out?
Not likely. The two kind of have different foraging habitats, different nesting habitats. So the bald eagles tend to be more focused on riverine systems. Fish is their primary food source in the wintertime, waterfowl, those kind of things. The golden eagle is more of an upland habitat species. Their decline is generally thought to be more habitat related, habitat conversion primarily, wildfires being a big component of that. The loss of the rabbits that they historically have preyed upon, now they have to prey on other species. So habitat conversion is one of the big concerns for golden eagles. And they're really kind of a solitary species, don't deal as well with human presence as bald eagles. You know, we've got bald eagles nesting in the Horan Natural Area, people parading by them all, you know, spring and summer. Golden eagles are not that tolerant of that kind of behavior activity around their nesting area. So they're just a little more solitary in that regard. So I think the trajectory of the two probably are relatively independent.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thanks. Thanks, both of you.
You're welcome.
Good presentation.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Randy, I do have one quick question before they're gone.
Okay.
And with respect to the Horan area, how unique is that to with respect to wildlife and the habitat that resides there to our habitat conservation obligations?
Is that a fish question or a wildlife question?
I guess it might, it could be both. Because I know we have the little canals that run through there, and I'm sure that applies
right.
to fish.
Yeah. Well, actually, the pond system is not connected directly to the river, except in high flow events. So we don't, and the water temperatures are way too high to support most fish and even some amphibian species, just because we don't have a flow through there. So the Horan area is not really the land part of it. Now, there's the Columbia River and the Wenatchee that border it that are certainly important for fish species, but the terrestrial part, even that holds the ponds, doesn't have a real fish component to it, just a lot of wildlife, certainly, but there are no requirements for us to have or maintain any specific condition there. Other than it's part of the state parks and it's a natural area that we said we would keep as such.
Right? I know I saw a picture of a moose that, and when I went there on a visitation, I saw the moose. Does that live there?
So which moose, which year, which, so, we have had, more moose in the last few years, and, it's not uncommon for moose to pass through Wenatchee in the spring, summertime periods. The last couple of years, two out of the last three, we've had some that have moved through, and, the Horan is the natural place for the state to want to push them to. It's, if we can get them in the Horan, then they're out away from the railroads, they're away from Wenatchee Avenue. So we tend to try to herd them in there, to keep them out of harm's way. And then they stay for a little while. And in the case of one of them, she stayed for 15, 16 months. And then she left. And then this, spring or, late spring, early summer, we had another, pair that came through, and they went into their Horan for a little while, and I'm told that they're still seen occasionally, but they tend to be transient in the area. We don't have any resident moose, for which I think I'm thankful. I mean, they're great to see on occasion, but we don't need to attract a bull moose in here during October. That would be could be problematic.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again.
Thanks.
So normally I would turn the next item over to the general manager, but I think I'll go directly to Kelly Boyd for an employee recognition.
Well, and I think even before it's my turn on that, I think we have the part two of our Fish and Wildlife presentation.
Oh, I thought both already.
Okay. Great. Okay. I just got clarification on that. So it is my turn. All right. So with that, our employee recognition for today is for Lorna. And Lorna is retiring September 15th, which is next week. So this is her last board meeting. And to recognize her, I'd like to read this message from our general manager, Steve Wright. I am so sorry I am unable to be at Lorna's last Board of Commissioners meeting, but while not physically present, I want to take the opportunity to thank her for her commitment to operational excellence, success for our customer owners, and the well-being of our employees. Lorna came to the district as a polished human resource professional with capability to oversee all HR functions. She has continually refined her skills while being a strong voice for human resource issues as a member of our senior team. Above all else, she is a hard worker. She regularly has exceeded expectations due to her commitment to deliver value, meeting the district's needs. She is highly trusted by the senior team due to her competence, work ethic, and high ethical standards. Lorna has been active in the community. I know that the Wenatchee Valley Museum has high regard for her service on the board as they have managed through some difficult HR issues. Personally, I want to thank Lorna for her service. She has been a tremendous partner, always focused on supporting the success of the district while helping me to understand what's possible, legal, and fair. I also appreciate that she is our best grammarian. I'm glad her tenure and mine have almost perfectly overlapped. Lorna has earned her retirement, and I wish her and Ron the best in the coming years. And Lorna, me too.
Oh,
congratulations.
Thank you, Kelly. Well, it's been my honor and my privilege to be part of this organization. We really have the most talented, dedicated, hardworking people here. I mean, they're really amazing, and we've done a lot of really amazing things over the last 7 years that I've been here, and I'm just really grateful to have had the opportunity to work with everybody and be part of what we do here. You know, again, we are not just trying to make a profit. We are here to serve the community the best way that we can and to provide clean power. And it's hard to beat that combination. So thank you all.
And if we would have our normal group of attendees, we would all be giving Lorna a hand.
Yes.
Thank you.
Brandy, I have a quick comment.
You bet.
Well, and I didn't prepare anything. I kind of forgot that today was your last meeting. But I just want to say I've loved working with you. I have a soft spot in my heart for disabled individuals and people that are facing tough times and struggling. And excuse me, I could always pick up the phone and call you, and you were there to support, the disabled individuals, the people who were struggling in many, many different ways. You always listened to me. You did everything you could. I just so appreciate that. That's meant so much. And you're a great professional, but you're also a wonderful, great human being, and I'll miss you. I wish you the best.
Thank you, Anne. That means a lot to me.
So, Lorna, we're all going to miss you. And while Anne's story is really touching, I think I had my own personal times with you on a personal level that I just need to second everything Anne has said about your caring about more than just doing a job. You cared about the people. And that's so huge. It makes a difference. So thank you. You will be missed.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Yes, if I could, I'd just like to say, Lorna, first of all, enjoy retirement. You've earned it. You've worked really hard, and you've given more to the district than the district really deserved to get. You've gone above and beyond and have really done a great job here. You will be missed. And all the expertise that you brought, but as my fellow commissioners have already said, it was more than that. It was the care, the concern, the genuine desire to help people. And that's getting to be a rare commodity these days. And so I really appreciate that you brought that to the district. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Arsenault.
Dennis.
Yeah, two things. Lorna, HR is kind of like trying to run through a minefield and not step on anything. It's difficult when you have 800 people with varying needs, and you've done a great job of guiding and directing the organization, meeting people's needs, and keeping us out of trouble. It's an easy area to get into trouble. It's an expert that keeps us out of it. So thank you. And then personally, last week I had a constituent ask a particularly awkward question. And not only did Lorna respond to it herself, she had two of her most capable people look into the issue. And within 2 days, I had an answer that I could deliver to our constituent. And that type of service and dedication is appreciated and will be missed. And so your concern about our customers, in your capacity is well demonstrated and much appreciated. Thank you.
You're welcome. And if I could say one more thing, and that is that I will really be able to enjoy my retirement because we've been very lucky to hire somebody really talented and smart to take my position. And Rosario Nystrom is going to be amazing. She already is.
I see several of your fellow senior managers have turned on their screens. Any other Anybody else would you like to comment about Lorna? It's not a roast time, guys, just so you know. It's, but it's tribute time. Anybody else?
I would. I'd just like to congratulate Lorna, and it's been a pleasure working with you, Lorna. This is Kirk, and you're going to be missed a lot, and wish you the best in retirement.
Thank you. Back at you, Kirk.
This is Justin. I also wanted to wish you the best, Lorna. Thank you for all of your help as helping me get situated here not so many months ago, or just a couple of years ago. So thank you, Lorna. Best wishes, and thanks for all your support.
Thank you.
Hi, Lorna. Sean, I wanted to thank you. It's been only a few months, but you've made my transition up to the Pacific Northwest much easier, and we'll miss being able to bounce ideas off you. I know I sometimes have crazy ones, and you put me in the right spot, so thank you for that.
Thanks.
Anybody else?
Well, yeah, this is Ian. I do want to thank Lorna. You know, I've gone through a challenging effort, and I really couldn't have done it in the reorganization without Lorna and her team. Some of the best, you know, work I've seen and working with people, and I really appreciate the effort that I've seen from Lorna. And even though I haven't worked that long with her, I expected this is, you know, her bar she's always set for all her career. So it's good to know that people really care about their jobs, and Lorna is definitely one of them. Thanks, Lorna.
Yeah, you're welcome. I am very lucky to have had an incredibly, again, dedicated and talented HR team. So they're the ones who really did the heavy lifting.
Thank you. All right. Well, we are at the end of our study session, and we will, it's a few minutes before 11, we'll move into our business session. I would anticipate we might be wrapped up with our business session about 11:30 and have time for a break before we go into executive session. So let's move into our business session. We have our consent agenda, which has been modified to include agenda item 7. Is there a motion for approval?
We accept the consent agenda as modified.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda as modified. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Opposed, the same sign? The consent agenda has been approved. Our next item is agenda item number 8, and I will turn the floor over to Lorna Klemanski.
So this item is a field order work change order for activities at Rocky Reach facilities. About $250,000 of changes have already been put in place, but we need board concurrence. And in addition, there's a need to address the roof, which really needs to be replaced. This is about a $750,000 cost. Thank you. And let me read the title of the resolution. And that is a resolution ratifying field work order numbers C-01, D-01 through D-16, and authorizing the general manager to execute field work order change orders numbers D-17 and D-18 for the Rocky Reach Hydroelectric Support Facility Improvements Project with Lighted Construction, Inc. of Spokane Valley, Washington.
Good morning, Commissioners. Casey Hall, Project Manager, Rocky Reach Central Maintenance Facilities. So as Lorna indicated, there's quite a few items in this resolution that we're requesting the board approve. I'll go into the roof specifically. I think Lorna summed up everything as far as the change orders and the ratifying the ones that have currently been executed, unless there's any specific questions about 17. Okay, so field work order change order 18 covers specifically the roof replacement on CM-17. You'll see that the change order amount is $695,000 for the roof replacement. The budget increase is $753,000. The reason why these are different is because the field work order change order doesn't have tax on it. So that budget increase includes the tax. So the roof. We started working through the abatement on the south end of the existing shop out here at CM. We were starting on the actual building, the new office building that's attached to the south end of CM-17. Started working with Leidig on staging our protection that was required under their contract for this existing roof. We're starting to look at how we were going to do that work with the contractor. Got up to do more investigating work on that roof, how we were going to apply the protection, and the roof is in a lot worse shape than we had hoped. Biggest issues with this roof are the fasteners and the lap sealant on the roof panels. So this is an actual exposed fastener roof. Rebecca, could you go to slide number 2? This is a picture of the west roof. This is similar, if you, CM-17, the existing shop building is the same, basically the same building as Pivus. So you've got two low roofs and then you have a tall roof on top. What we're looking at here is the west roof looking south. And in the background, you can see that yellow board, that's CM-24 that we're currently under construction with. So in this picture, you can see these fasteners in rows down the roof. So this is our biggest problem. These are starting to fail. They've come up and actually done patchwork on these fasteners in the past. What the fastener incorporates is you have an actual screw, and then there's a metal washer and then a rubber gasket. So that is screwed down. That rubber gasket is your seal on that roof when you're attaching it to the substrate of those panels to the substrate. So those are failing. Also, this lap sealant, you can see underneath some of this blocking is super brittle. We also have some damage to the panels that we didn't know about, where they haven't failed yet. This one looks like it has. Just kind of see that blotch of sealant on the second raised rib. But we have the same problem on these other couple ribs. So we started again, with this, the degraded fasteners, started working with Leidig on how we were going to protect this roof. To do this work, we have to, part of the scope of this building is to replace these windows, these clear story windows you can see in the photograph. They all have to be abated, removed. So in order to, and then also this building's being seismically upgraded. So we have steel going in this building once it gets, all the skin comes off. So we have to drop steel down through the superstructure. So we've got to have people up there. And the way to protect it is to put plywood down to protect it. So now you get people starting to walk up on this roof. These gaskets start to fail. You may not see it right away. It may take a year or so, but they'll crack. And then we have a water leakage point into the building. So we looked at, okay, is there another way we could solve this problem without having to completely replace the roof? Bottom line, going through this exercise, is the district's taking on a big amount of risk by trying to just put a Band-Aid on this roof and not replace it. I say that as, okay, example, what we've looked at doing was, let's just go and replace all these bad fasteners. We'll replace all the fasteners on the roof. Replace all the lap sealant so we have these good attachment points on the roof. We do that, we don't get a warranty with that. That's you go up there and replace it. No contractor would give us a warranty on a roof like if we made that type of replacement. Whereas if we did the replacement, we get a 30-year warranty on that roof. and if there's a problem, they come back and fix it. We have a way to make the district whole if we have damage. The same goes for the inside of the building. You know, trying to work out that relationship with Leidig on, okay, what if we have a leak on that roof? Since we don't have a warranty on that roof, and we're trying to figure out who's responsible for it, the district would most likely end up being on the hook to make any replacements under the warranty period with Leidig for that year. And then if we had a leak a year and a half later, 2 years, we'd be making that repair and paying for it. Whereas, again, if we had that 30-year warranty on that roof, it's taken care of, we at least can go back and get compensation to do those repairs. So that's why the project team and staff is recommending we just replace this roof. There's too many risks about, like I just described, of not doing that. Looking at the budgeting for this, we're not, as I had indicated, on the two new buildings, CM24, the office building, which you can see in the foreground in this, or the background of this picture, and 22, those aren't scheduled to be completed until November for 24, and then the shop, CM22, January. So we wouldn't need, we wouldn't have to do a special budget increase this year. That work's not going to happen until next year, so it'd just be, if the board commission approves the increase, we would just do that through the normal budgeting process in December, because we won't get to that work until most likely late winter to early spring. That's when we'll start the demolition work. So any questions on the roof condition or anything else in the resolution as far as the change orders, ratification, anything?
Just a quick question. What year was that building built?
I believe it was, it's the same vintage as the, is Rocky Reed, so in the, it would have been late 50s. The roof's been replaced since then, but yeah, okay. It was in the 50s.
Okay.
Randy, yeah. I have a question.
Yes.
So Casey, it looks like that roof has served us well for many years, and the one question that I have as we move towards if we could put that picture back up for a minute, Rebecca. My question has to do with you. If you look down the line, and I, this is kind of a question. It appears to me there's a drip edge above it. Those above those windows, the snow is sliding off and damaging that roof below. Is that an accurate assessment of what I see there?
Yes, that's correct. So go ahead.
Are we going to be putting in snow stops as part of the new? Or what are we doing to prevent that damage from occurring with the new roof?
So the new roof type is a membrane, not a. A metal panel. It's a membrane roof. So we'll still have ice from that upper roof coming down. I believe in the design, what we're looking at is putting some rakes on that upper section to stop that problem.
And you can put rakes on with a membrane roof?
Yeah, there'll be special waterproofing attachments. So similar to like a HVAC unit that you put on a roof, you're going to have a steel structure that air handler sits on, and you waterproof flash around the actual penetrations. Mm. So it'd be something like that where we go back and flash specifically around those penetrations for that.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I have a question.
Yeah. Yep.
If the building was built in the 50s, you know, what's the life expectancy of that building? If we put a 30-year roof on a building that lasts for 15 years, maybe what we should be talking about is replacing the entire building. Can you give me your best estimate on what is the life expectancy of that building?
Great question. So we expect to get, with the renovations we're making on this structure, we're planning on getting that 50-year life out of that structure. So the roof was part of the building, but everything else, the siding's all asbestos. It's all coming off. It's basically getting stripped on the inside down to its bones. And then we're redoing all of the mechanical, electrical, seismically upgrading the steel inside the building. So if we put a roof on it, then we're really providing that strategic goal of giving that structure a 50-year life.
I see. Thank you. Yeah, mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Any other questions? Thank you, Casey.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Resolution 9.
This is a resolution authorizing the general manager to enter into a services agreement, SA number 21-11722, with Blue Leaf Environmental, Inc. of Ellensburg, Washington, for conducting white sturgeon monitoring and evaluation activities required in the Rocky Reach license. And Lance Keller will tell us about this item.
Thank you, Lorna. And good morning, commissioners. Lance Keller, senior fisheries biologist. I'm here today to present the resolution that Lorna introduced regarding our continued monitoring and evaluation of the white sturgeon population in the Rocky Reach Reservoir for years 2021 through 2025. Next slide, please, Rebecca. Thank you. Why we're here today, we're here to request funding for the M&E in a five-year not to exceed of $1,397,136, and this is included in the 21-25 budget. Next slide, please, record. Do I have control? Oh, okay, thank you. Brief background here. We did make an initial presentation on this M&E. We lightly touched on it during the May 3, 2021 Board of Commissioners meeting. We were there specifically to approve two resolutions for a change that we made in how we collect or source our juvenile sturgeon for Rocky Reach Reservoir and where we rear them. But we did take that opportunity to prompt the board that we would be coming back at a later date with a contract for continued monitoring and evaluation of the population in the Rocky Reach Reservoir. Real briefly, our monitoring evaluation consists of us first off releasing juvenile white sturgeon to the Rocky Reach Reservoir per our Rocky Reach White Sturgeon Management Plan. When those fish are released, they are all individually pit tagged and scoop marked, so we do have an individual ID or a name for each individual fish. We also do have a size and length point at release, so we know how big and how long those fish are. And then our monitoring evaluation effort, which has been conducted by Blue Leaf from 2013 through 2020, they go out and they deploy set lines in the reservoir that we let soak for 24 hours. Sturgeon that are in that area then eat the bait that's on the hook. They get captured. We bring the line in. We're then able to interrogate those individuals that are caught for that pit tag. We have a database on the boat that then tells us when that fish was released, when it was last captured, its size and length, that release and capture, and then we take that corresponding data once again for that specific data point, as well as a capture location that provides us with distribution, growth rates, and also survival and adult abundance target or goals, excuse me, or data points, rather. We ultimately take all that data, and then we use that to assess what the overall adult abundance could be once these fish continue to age based on their survival and abundance at that time. Why this is so important is that, first off, sturgeon are sturgeon and they are not salmon or steelhead. Typically, our office does work predominantly with salmon and steelhead species. The life cycle is 3 to 5 years, and then we can make a change and see an adjustment in our strategy. Sturgeon are very different. They are a resident fish. They are resident fish species that are very long-lived. Adults, it is not unheard of for adults to live beyond 50 years and grow in sizes exceeding 8 feet in length. Once those fish get to a size possibly around 2 feet. They are ultimately what we would call an apex predator in the reservoir, meaning that really the only predator to the sturgeon at that point is man through a harvest implementation, or activity. And then they ultimately are at large and can prey upon any prey that's in the reservoir. We have done brief diet work on this population specific to Rocky Reach, and we have found out that these fish are extremely opportunistic. We have actually found traces of mammals, birds, rodents, insects, worms, other fish. Pretty much if they can get it in their mouth and keep it in their mouth, they're going to consume it. So because of that, we want to make sure that we're informed on the current status of the population and how that population is changing, so we can then inform our stakeholders and then negotiate appropriate stocking levels going forward to ensure that we don't stock too many apex predators. So I showed this slide at our May Board of Commissioners meeting, and this has been updated currently through 2020. And I'll take a little bit of time here to orientate the Board of Commissioners to this slide before we talk about the actual data. So over here on the left-hand side of all three of these diagrams is Rocky Reach Dam, and up on the right-hand side is Wells Dam. So essentially this diagram left to right represents the bottom to the top of the Rocky Reach Reservoir. We can see in this lower picture here, we have the confluence of the Aniat and the Columbia River down here in this vicinity. And then farther up here, we actually have the Chelan River and Columbia River confluence to give folks some orientation here. This data depicts the distribution of sturgeon that we have observed since releasing fish back in 2011 with active tags. So we actually have planted some tags that do have a battery life but do provide much more resolution and do not require us to actually put our hands on the fish or recapture that fish. And then we deployed strategic detection points or gates so we can tell where these fish are moving upstream or downstream. And then overlapping this with the annual M&E data that we get, we can actually see distribution differences based on size or the year that the fish was released and how old it was. And ultimately, you can see in this top region here, or the top diagram, excuse me, we see a lot of fish utilizing the upper reservoir of Rocky Reach, of the Rocky Reach pool, mainly from BB Bridge to the immediate tail race of Wells. This was very predominant in the early years of data that we received from the M&E program. But since then, we've seen more of a redistribution of fish utilizing the lower end of the reservoir in the Aniat Daroga area. And some of the growth data that we actually have from this has shown that we are starting to see a decrease in the growth rate of fish that do elect to go up to the immediate Wells tail race area, and those that actually do choose to either stay in the Aniat area or move down to the Aniat area actually have larger growth rates, kind of possibly hinting that we might be seeing some effect of so many fish electing to go up to the Wells area. So this is an example of some of the data that is valuable, possibly showing that maybe there's starting to get a certain headcount of fish in the immediate Wells tail race that might be cause to say, you know what, maybe too many fish here are causing fish to not grow or survive at a rate that they should. These circles, the size of these circles kind of depict the average residency time we've seen of those fish. So while we have seen residence times up at Wells of individual fish up to 153 days, this was very common in the early data set, but we're now starting to see that down the Aniat Daroga area as well. And for the second slide, we showed this in a similar fashion in May as well. These are some of the survival estimates that we've been able to derive from the M&E effort to date based on what year those fish were released. So on the left-hand side of both of these graphs, we have the first release of fish in 2011. And then all the way over to the right, we have the group that was released last in 2019. The bar color corresponds with where these fish were located. Early on in our supplementation efforts, we did release fish only near the upper end of the reservoir for fear that releasing them lower in the reservoir might not give them enough time to find suitable habitat and they might actually emigrate out of the project area. The early M&E data illustrated that was definitely not the concern, and we definitely might be biasing the results and distribution by releasing fish that high up in the Rocky Reach Reservoir. So we started doing releases at the BB Park area, the Daroga boat launch and the Aniat boat launch. And so based on knowing where those fish were released, we can actually derive specific survival estimates based on that data point. And you can see here, the top graph shows the early survival that we observe in fish. And it wasn't too many years ago, we actually saw a pretty good uptick in survival of fish, kind of irregardless of where you were released. And now we're actually observing, over the last years, we've observed a decrease in that, possibly insinuating that when population levels are high, those fish that first release out into the reservoir in the first year, they might have a bit of a diminished survival. And this is a very, very valuable data point when we're considering the number or the appropriate number of fish to stock. We can also see that once fish make it through that early post-release survival period, their long-term survival is very, very high. And this supports the fact that once those fish get to about 2 feet in length, they're pretty much bulletproof, quote bulletproof that we say, and they have been able to find their suitable habitat and are able to forage and maintain a high rate of survival going forward. Ultimately, what we are being tasked with right now with our external stakeholders, we are taking all this survival data from numerous recapture events, and we are populating an adult abundance survival model that ultimately project and see how our stocking program is doing in the Rocky Reach Reservoir relative to an adult abundance target that our stakeholders would like to see the reservoir achieve over the life of the license, that adult abundance being 2,760 adults. It was not foreseen that we would be doing this much or this intense of an M&E effort early on in the license, but given that sturgeon are so long-lived and that we are seeing a rapid change in the population dynamics compared to the first fish that went in 2011 to the fish that we're putting in now, district staff views that it's very valuable to continue this effort in the immediate time frame with hopes in the next 5 years we could possibly back off to that original time frame that was speculated in the settlement agreement of conducting this activity maybe every 1 to 3 years. So in summary, this agreement is for a 5-year not to exceed of $1,397,136. We are going to continue to ask Blue Leaf to conduct this work. We continue to see a very high level of performance and cost effectiveness from Blue Leaf. Blue Leaf also just completed our 2021 Rock Island HCP confirmation survival study yearling Chinook. Blue Leaf consistently meets all the targets set by the district and also comes in under budget on every agreement that we have with them. And like I said during the last slide, while this effort might be a little bit more on a higher frequency than initially intended, we are hopeful by getting some additional data in hand that we can back off on the intensity of the monitoring evaluation effort in the coming years of the Rocky Reach White Sturgeon Manager. And with that, I would take any questions that the Board of Commissioners might have.
Commissioners, any questions? Very thorough, and that's a fascinating fish. I've always been fascinated by sturgeon, and will there ever be a season for sturgeon in our pond 10, 15, 20 years down the road?
Yeah, that's a great question, Commissioner Smith. So our white sturgeon management plan for Rocky Reach does call out some level of harvest when it is appropriate. And based on the fact that these fish are apex predators, I do believe we will see a harvest, and I'm hopeful that the district can actually use that as a viable tool should this M&E data continue to inform us and possibly say that there's too many fish in the reservoir. We have seen that in neighboring project areas where a harvest element, number one, is extremely desired by the public and tribal fishermen as well. And then also has been a very suitable tool to decrease the overall headcount of sturgeon in a specific reservoir. So yes, kind of a long answer, but yes, we most likely can anticipate a harvest opportunity down the road.
Okay. Any other questions, Commissioner? Go ahead.
A question with respect to the do we have any studies, any data on how the sturgeon impact the salmon? whether it's the Chinook or any of the other fish in our reservoir that we are responsible for, are they having any kind of a meaningful negative impact on the survival of those fish?
Yeah, that's a great question, Commissioner Arsenault. So currently we do not have any data that is indicating that there is a negative impact on the return of adult salmon or steelhead in our project area. But something that our staff continues in our office continues to be a bit cautious about is with these fish being an apex predator, we do have in our settlement agreement a Pacific lamprey management plan as well. And it is well documented in the literature that white sturgeon are a very effective predator on returning adult lamprey. So once again, utilizing the data we have from M&E and acknowledging that we might possibly have some conflicting management plans with the stocking of sturgeon and the predation on Pacific lamprey management plan just further goes to illustrate that we need to make sure that we get this white sturgeon population, essentially the foundation of what we're putting out in the first few years of the license, really in tune and in check with the overall ecosystem in the Rocky Reach Reservoir.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Great presentation. That was interesting. Commissioners, we have resolutions 8 and 9 that need approval. Is there a motion to approve those two motions or those two resolutions?
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of resolutions 8 and 9 as presented.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded that we approve resolutions 8 and 9. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion is carried. Do we have any manager items today?
We do. Our first one is Ron Auger with Cord Network Replacement, if Ron is on the line.
Yes, I am.
Great. Thank you, Ron.
Hi there. Hi there. My name is Ron Auger. I'm Supervisor of Network Operations for the Fiber to the Home Network for the Schilling County PD, obviously. This is has to do with a replacement of our main infrastructure for supporting the fiber to the home network. So basically, we recently completed it. It was called our Layer 2 project. We replaced some of our core equipment with more inexpensive, yet faster, more capable equipment recently during this project. And it basically is all of our backbone and core electronic devices is what we replaced. In doing so, we accomplished multiple things. Luckily, this aligned perfectly with the product or the device's end of life announcement. So basically, the manufacturers have said that this stuff is end of life. We're not going to support it anymore and continue to update and so on and so forth. So they have a different replacement model that they suggested that we replace it with. Although, during our investigation of the different equipment that was available to us, we determined that we didn't need the high, the routing that they were trying to sell us in the equipment. So we opted to go with some equipment that was a lot more efficient for what we had planned for our network. And we went ahead with that purchase. So with installing this, we also were coming to a head, like I said, where the equipment was becoming end of life. We were also at a point to where our network was starting to have an increase of bandwidth consumption. And so we try to stay ahead of the bandwidth consumption on the network. That way we don't run into any bandwidth bottlenecks. And the customer owners, don't experience any slowdowns on the network. So we're able to accomplish both at the same time, replacing the equipment that's end of life and upgrading our network to about 10 times the capacity on the bandwidth. Wow. Yeah, so it's 100 gig backbone now, and it was a 10 gig backbone. And so we've 10 times our increased capacity. So we're definitely, we've fortified it for the future. And we could have went to a 40 gig solution, which was an interim solution, but it was ended up being, the cost, it was more cost effective to go to 100 gig than it was 40 gig at this time. So, 4 or 5 years ago, it may not have been, but at this point, it was more inexpensive and just better solution for us. Future upgrades would be a lot more transparent to the customer and so on and so forth in this scenario. So we are staying above the bottlenecks and above the bandwidth curve. That's what we're trying to do, just so we don't have any slowdowns or complaints on the network. And this benefits our customer owners. It also benefits the service providers because they can say that, we don't have any bottlenecks, we don't have slowdowns. And now they can even tout that we do have a 100 gig ring on the fiber network. And so we have plenty of bandwidth growth and plenty of capacity there for the future. So don't know how long. Bandwidth was doubling about every 2 years for quite some time. It's since slowed down, surprisingly, the last couple of years with COVID even. We saw a bump when COVID came to us in 2020. But now, as soon as that little hump was over, it's kind of normalized. We do see it increasing slightly, but definitely not doubling every 2 years like we had predicted. So other benefits that we get from this are we reduced our operating expenses by going with the non-routing equipment. It's just switching instead of routing, so it's less expensive equipment. We don't really need the routing function, and so that was definitely a cost savings there, because the ongoing monthly maintenance or yearly maintenance is a lot less expensive for this type of equipment. We also were able to get our service providers redundant connections. Before, they only had single home connections from our network, and now not all of them, and I'm working on getting the rest of them, but now they all have two connections to the fiber to home network, whereas if one connection fails, they do have a backup to get to our network. So that is a huge benefit for them and for our customer owners as well, because they will have, it'll be transparent to them if we do have a failure on the network.
Thank you, Ron.
So I think that's it. Any questions at all?
Nice to hear that 100 gigabyte.
Yeah. It's really actually pretty impressive for a little Wenatchee, fiber to the home network. But it's definitely, it'll get us by for quite some time now. I'm excited.
Thank you.
And our next manager item is Justin Erickson on public power benefit solicitations.
Good morning, commissioners. We last spoke with you about public power benefit at your June 1st meeting, and we talked about the solicitation process beginning this fall. And so here we are, and our official launch is actually today. And we've been publicizing the September 7th timeframe for a little while now on our website, and we'll have a mention of the effort in the Connected newsletter, which will hit your mailbox, I believe, this week as well. And we'll be taking the next several months to engage with the public, discuss the opportunity with city councils, elected officials, organizations, and nonprofits, and hopefully be in a position to bring you some project ideas late this year, as we have our normal check-in, generally in the December, at one of your December meetings. So those of you that may have questions from the public, we have a lot of information on our website at the Public Power Benefit link, including a short video that explains the process. Of course, we're harkening back and anchoring to the strategic plan, where we speak in depth about what the public power benefit opportunity is and what it can be used for, and really where it's not applicable, and that we need a nexus to our statutory mission. And you might recall in our strategic plan,
We've got a series of themes that we note relative to the public power benefit program, as well as some project categories that the topic team reviewed and established. So we feel like we're in pretty good footing with the work that was done recently in strategic planning. And we have, so we will be soliciting for the remainder of 2022 funding, which is around $1.5 million. And then this will dovetail nicely with the 2023 budgetary process, where we have that opportunity annually to check in with where the district's finances are and allocate the PPV funding for the upcoming year. And if trends continue and we have allocation for 2023, we would have about $3.9 million that's not allocated already. So there's a significant amount of money between 2022 and 2023 to allocate towards projects. Looking forward to engaging with the public. Be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions? Thank you. Good report. Any other manager items?
That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Lisa Sanders, Commission Travel.
Hello. We don't have a lot going on. I wonder if anyone's heard about the NWPPA conference. Will that be offered virtually? I haven't seen anything.
Lisa, the last email that I received, which was probably 3 weeks ago, mentioned that it would not be virtual. Whether that's changed now with the ramp up and the Delta COVID virus, I don't know.
Okay.
But that was what I heard 3 weeks ago.
Commissioner, yes.
You know, I think it is virtual, but I can check for you, Lisa. As soon as we hang up, I'll check that.
Okay.
Lynn, Ann, would you send me an email too if you find
sure.
out that it is?
I will.
If it is, I would like to be involved in it.
Yeah, I'll do that as soon as we hang up.
Okay.
Thanks, Ann.
Thank you. So, Commissioner Congdon is registered, so we'll have to check back if it's not virtual, I guess. We'll follow up on that. The September WAPUTA meetings.
All virtual.
They are virtual. Okay. So I'll register for those. Commissioner Congdon, the water workshop is confirmed to be virtual. So I'll make sure you're registered for that.
Thank you.
If it's needed. Do you want to move into October or should we wait and see how things progress?
Let's hold off and see if there's change. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything else I can help you with? Any questions? Comment?
Nope.
Okay. I asked you earlier about a flight credit of $216, and I think I'm going to guess the origins of that might have been APPA back to D.C. in 2020. Could you confirm that for me? Because it looked like that expired May of 21.
I sent you a email copy of that information.
Yes, it shows the credit from Alaska, but it doesn't say from what.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. I'll check it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else on commission travel? Do we have any commissioner items? Okay, then follow up on delegation of action items from the previous meeting.
So there were no action items from the August 16th board meeting. from a previous board meeting, there had been an item to come back with follow-up information on the UW NOAA and David Welch ocean condition studies regarding salmon and steelhead survival, and that was reported today in the Fish and Wildlife update.
Okay, thank you. Did we have anything for delegation today?
I didn't hear any, no. And Rebecca doesn't have any either.
Did we miss anything?
Not that I know. So this is the moment for any additional public comment. Is there any public on the line that wishes to have any comment today? Are there any other matters to come before the commission before we move into executive session? Hearing none, following a 10-minute break, we will move into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCWs, and to consider information regarding the infrastructure and security of computer and telecommunications networks, security and service recovery plans, security risk assessment, and security test results to the extent that they identify specific system vulnerabilities pursuant to the RCWs, and to plan the strategy or position to be taken during the course of collective bargaining as authorized by the RCWs for approximately 60 minutes. So we'll take a 10-minute break, come back at approximately 15 minutes to 12, and have a one-hour executive session. We have to hang up and dial back into the executive session number. See you in a few minutes. Executive session, and we find ourselves in need of some additional time. We're going to add 30 minutes to our executive session, and we will be going right back into executive session. We are coming out of executive session. It is 1:19. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we will stand adjourned.